Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. This year's Supreme Court term ends today, and this morning we received the court's two final decisions. In the most watched case this year, Sebelius versus Hobby Lobby, the Supreme Court ruled that closely held corporations do not have to provide certain kinds of contraceptive coverage to their employees if it violates their religious beliefs. The 5-4 vote challenges the contraceptive coverage mandate in the Affordable Care Act. Two corporations brought on the case, saying the mandate violates their religious principles. The court found that the company's rights were protected under the 1993 Religious Freedom Restoration Act. In her dissent, Ruth Bader Ginsburg wrote, quote, "The court, I fear, has ventured into a minefield," end quote. And in another case involving reproductive health issues, the court struck down a Massachusetts law that makes it a crime to stand on a public road or sidewalk within 35 feet of an abortion clinic. The court sided with a group of abortion opponents who argued that the law was unconstitutional because it prevented them from counseling women entering the clinics. And we also got decisions recently affecting cell phone searches, greenhouse gas emissions, and public sector union fees. So on today's Your Call, we are discussing the latest decisions. What do you want to know about these decisions? And which cases have you been following closely? Today, we're joined by Jody Jacobson. She's editor-in-chief of RH Reality Check, a daily publication providing news, commentary, and analysis on sexual and reproductive health and justice issues. Hi, Jody. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, how are you? Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for joining us. We're also joined by Tejinder Singh, an attorney with Goldstein and Russell and a contributor to the SCOTUS blog. Tejinder has argued before the Supreme Court and lower courts in matters involving civil rights, financial regulation, privacy, and environmental protection. Hi, Tejinder. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. And Jesse Choper is the Earl Warren Professor of Public Law at UC Berkeley. He has taught and written about constitutional law and the Supreme Court. Hi, Professor Choper. Thanks again for joining us.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
Great to have you. So, Jody, I want to start off with you and talk about the Hobby Lobby case. But before we dive in and talk about this decision, I want to go back in history a bit because I'm not really hearing this in the media. What was covered before the mandate in the Affordable Care Act? What did health insurance companies cover contraception before this mandate? And if so, do you have a percentage? How many covered it?
I'm reluctant to give a percentage only because it's been far enough away from that data when we were covering the ACA that I don't remember the percentages well. But it's safe to say that 87% of women who were employed full-time had coverage that covered either or both of contraception and abortion services. So what happened actually was that as part of let's hate on everything President Obama does, and as part of the growing strength of the religious rights corporate and electoral power in the country, they used Obamacare to sort of as a lever to get rid of things that they didn't like before. One thing they obviously are against is women having access to contraception. And so even though some of these same companies, including Hobby Lobby, were covering contraception before the birth control benefit, they became the lead plaintiffs in this case.
Okay, so a lot of health insurance companies covered and corporations covered contraception before the mandate. What changed when the Affordable Care Act passed?
Well, actually, two things I want to mention just quickly before I go into that, which is that in the news clip before, there was something that the announcer said, which was that the case was about free birth control. And this is a completely mistaken portrayal. It is about earned benefits. People earn insurance coverage through their work. So there's nothing free about it. That's the first thing. The second thing is, again, since most people were covered and many of these same people, including the Catholic bishops, were covering birth control before the birth control benefit, what changed is that they saw a political lever for using the law and Obamacare to get rid of contraception coverage. In other words, most insurance companies recognize the public health benefit and the cost savings from covering contraception. Why? Because contraception, when used to prevent unplanned pregnancies, is much less expensive than the other alternatives, including unwanted births. And the second thing is that for those people who need it for medical purposes, it's also much more cost-effective than, for example, treating endometriosis in a way when it's gone, you know, when it's gotten too far along. So my point is that this was a sane public health and cost-effective thing, insurance companies included. Once you had Obamacare saying you must include it, the far right saw a way of leveraging that to get rid of contraception per se.
Okay, and so the other important part of this is that the court ruled that closely held corporations do not have to provide certain kinds of coverage to their employees if it violates their religious beliefs. So Hobby Lobby is a crafts store. They've got 500 stores nationwide. They employ 20,000 people. And what I've been hearing this morning, in fact, the BBC just reported that this applies to small family-run businesses. But let's define closely held corporation, because that's really important. I mean, a lot of announcers are saying that this is a very narrow decision because it only applies to closely held corporations. But we're talking about some massive corporations here.
Well, I think the question of what is a closely held corporation is now in debate, because I'm seeing discussions among lawyer friends and others who are trying to get a handle on what exactly does this mean. For example, under one interpretation of closely held corporation, you could say Walmart is a closely held corporation because it's controlled by the Walton family. It depends how you look at the definition of closely held corporation. I don't know the answer to that. I think that's going to have to be sussed out. But it certainly, first of all, it sets a precedent for lots of businesses that are run by people who, you know, object to contraception based on their religious faith to now come forward and say, we just don't want to do this, which means that lots of women are no longer covered for a basic primary public health intervention and a preventive health care intervention. Secondly, there's a false argument being played here because Hobby Lobby claimed that it was providing contraception under its original policy and would be made to provide contraception that were abortifacients, which the science shows is completely false. So what you have today is the Supreme Court not only handing a religious hammer to business owners over women employees, but also effectively giving a Supreme Court seal to misinformation and false information.
So Hobby Lobby was opposed to two forms of contraception, the morning after pill and the IUD. So are they going to still cover birth control pills?
That is my understanding right now is that that remains to be seen, because my understanding right now is that they've removed all contraceptive coverage from their plan and that whether they go back to having contraception of any kind. But my understanding is also that many of these groups claim that the birth control pill is an abortifacient. So, again, I think it's somewhat up in the air what actually is going to happen. But what it definitely is not up in the air is that women have no certainty of covering one of the most expensive medical one of the highest medical expenses that they have in their lifetimes, and receiving it as part of their health care plan.
In her dissent, Justice Ginsburg wrote, quote, "It bears note in this regard that the cost of an IUD is nearly equivalent to a month's full-time pay for workers earning the minimum wage," end quote. And that is Jody Jacobson. She's editor-in-chief of RH Reality Check. Tejinder, I wanted to ask you about this because many in the media are saying that this is a narrow decision. What is your read on it?
Well, I mean, everything is relative, right? It's narrower than it could have been in the sense that, you know, there are limitations in the court's opinion. And one can ask whether these are principled limitations that will hold up over time or whether they're artificial limitations that won't. So, for example, you know, one limitation is, as we've been discussing, that this applies only to closely held companies. And if that's true, you know, there's a fight to be had about what is and isn't closely held. I think at a minimum it's clear that no publicly traded company would be regarded as closely held under this court's opinion, because it expressly distinguishes publicly held companies. And, you know, you can have a dispute about whether, you know, privately held companies where where it's not just members of one family and so on, whether those count. So there is that limitation. Another limitation, and this is a little, this looks a little bit artificial, is the court says, you know, this only applies to these forms of contraception, which are the subject of a religious belief that no one has attempted to dispute. And so if there's a future case where there's a fight about whether a religious belief is sincerely held, you know, that might be a limitation on the court's holding. Additionally, when you get into healthcare measures other than contraception, things like vaccines, blood transfusions, and so on, the court expressly stated that that stuff is not, you know, at issue in this case. Now, like I said, those sorts of distinctions may not hold up over time, but at the moment, at least, those are all arguments for saying that this is a relatively narrow decision.
Professor Chopper, what's your read on this decision?
Well, I don't disagree very much at all with, I guess I'll put it the other way, I agree with almost everything that Sajandra said. I think they read congressional intent in a way that gives a broad protection to religious freedom. I think that that is what the intention of the RFRA was. They were willing to assume that birth control may be a compelling government interest for many women, but that there are other ways in which they could handle this sort of matter, the same way they've handled it for nonprofit corporations. I mean, it's simple enough to say that if the government really wants to do this, they can pay for it themselves, which is what they did under the Affordable Care Act for nonprofit corporations. How many of these there will be? Oh, I don't know. I mean, I think you can speculate all you want about what is a closely held corporation under these circumstances, but there's only one way to find what the answer is, and that's to wait for a Supreme Court decision on it.
Hmm.
But this was wholly owned by the families, as I understand the facts of the case, and there was so there was no other people that owned it. We used to have a lot of pretty big corporations that were like that, but not today. Any longer.
Justice Ginsburg also wrote, would the exemption extend to employers with religiously grounded objections to blood transfusions, antidepressants, medications derived from pigs, pills coated with gelatin, and vaccinations? Not much help there for the lower courts bound by today's decision.
The answer is you don't know about that either. I mean, I think, for example, the danger posed by not being vaccinated, if you can demonstrate it, is you're going to have a widespread disease, presents an equally or clearly compelling interest. You're talking about life under those circumstances. And I just don't think that you can read what was deliberately made to be a somewhat narrow decision by the Supreme Court, although a very meaningful one. A very meaningful one, both to the workers and to the employers, but any other kind of situation. I think you have to be engaged in real speculation in order to do that. And most of these questions ultimately only will be answered by the Supreme Court.
That is Jesse Chopper, Earl Warren Professor of Public Law at UC Berkeley, who has taught and written about the Supreme Court. Tejinder Singh is an attorney with Goldstein and Russell and a contributor to the SCOTUS blog. He's argued before the Supreme Court and lower courts in matters involving civil rights and privacy rights. And Jody Jacobson is editor-in-chief of RH Reality Check, a daily publication focusing on sexual and reproductive health and justice issues. We're going to spend a few more minutes on Hobby Lobby, and then we will talk about buffer zones around women's health clinics. We'll also talk about the decision affecting cell phone searches, greenhouse gas emissions, public sector unions, fees. And if you'd like to join us, if you have any questions about these decisions, what do you think specifically about Hobby Lobby? This was one of the most watched cases this year. We'd love to hear from you. If you have if you're covered by your employer, and you know, do you know if you work for a closely held corporation? And what are your thoughts now that your employer can decide whether or not birth control will be covered moving forward? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. You can also leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. So, Jody, again, I guess so much of this is up in the air, but according to Political Rift, and NPR talked about this today, you could argue that Hilton is a closely held corporation, Dell is a closely held corporation, even Koch Industries. So as a someone who takes birth control as a woman, is it now our responsibility to ask our employer if they cover birth control, or are corporations going to issue statements? I mean, how is this going to work moving forward?
I mean, basically, and I'd like to respectfully disagree with my colleagues on the call, you can only see this as a narrow decision if you think that the prospect of tens of thousands of women and perhaps hundreds of thousands of women across the country who are employed by large employers like Hobby Lobby, have lost a very critical form of health care, and that's a narrow thing. You can only decide that if you don't see the opening that's given to just the kinds of corporations you are talking about now somehow to bring claims against us and tie up the courts with those things. I'm not suggesting Coca-Cola is going to do that. I'm not suggesting Hewlett-Packard's going to do it. But I am saying that what you've created is several fold. One, you've got the Supreme Court essentially saying that birth control and contraception is not a public health intervention of great import because the narrow religious belief of an organization that claims to be a corporation, that claims to be a person, has more sway than the individuals who have earned the benefit of deciding on their own health care. The second thing is that, you know, we have a critical emergency in this country of an inability to make policy and law on anything. So to suggest that the government has another way of getting to providing widespread access to contraception is to live in an era of unreality, just like suggesting that, you know, there are other ways of dealing with the buffer zone problem. There really aren't effective other ways unless you assume that women have to be accosted and harassed to the point of bringing a lawsuit in order to access reproductive health care, like was suggested in McCullen. So what you've got here is a fairly profound decision for the lives of women who will not be able to access care without being themselves publicly owned and publicly scrutinized.
What about the argument, Jody? Some people say if the government believes so strongly in this, the Obama administration, then it should pay for contraception.
And, well, I would say that the government does pay for contraception through Title X, it pays through it through Medicaid, it pays through it through various means, but there are means tests for those. We see that many states have refused to expand Medicaid. We see that Title X is under attack. In many, many states, legislatures have stripped family planning budgets and have shifted actual family planning dollars to crisis pregnancy centers, which not only misinform women, but don't provide any form of birth control. So I would say, again, that is living in a different reality than the one that we have in this country today. It is not going to happen very soon that appropriations will be made in Congress or that authorizations will be made for expanding eligibility of Medicare, or Medicaid rather, in order to be able to expand access to contraception. I don't know, you know, what Congress, anyone who's suggesting that, is looking at today.
Tejinder or Professor Chopra, your response?
Sure. You know, I want to make it clear that, you know, there's a, just to say that the decision, that there's a way to read the decision as narrow is not to say that the decision is unimportant, right? Some of the most important features of the decision, I think, are, of course, the impact on existing health plans and the fact that the Religious Freedom Restoration Act was just applied for the first time you know, to recognize religious rights for a for-profit corporation. These are big moves in the law, and they're very important. And they may lead in the future to very widespread changes in how business is done. And that's something that folks who are concerned about that need to be very vigilant about. But that's not the same as saying this is a broad decision today. And, you know, folks who are concerned about this, I think, actually have more reason to be cautious with their rhetoric. And I'll give the example from the other side. When the United States Supreme Court decided that the Defense of Marriage Act was unconstitutional, Justice Scalia wrote a dissent flipping out about it, explaining how it was going to open the door and destroy all regulation of marriage. And sure enough, since he wrote that dissent, it's been cited many, many times by courts saying that different marriage bans in the states are unconstitutional. And so I think that, you know, by overreading what that decision meant, the dissent really gave a lot of fuel to folks challenging laws that Justice Scalia, I'm sure, would like to still see on the books. And I think it's very possible to do that here with Hobby Lobby as well. You know, I think recognizing the limitations of the decision and attempting to hold the court to them, just from the standpoint of someone who clearly is very passionate about this subject, you know, is the far better approach than throwing up one's arms and exclaiming about how the world has already ended. And so, you know, I would say that it is true, this is a really important decision, but it's also narrow and important respect, and it's a good idea to focus on the ways that it is.
Well, we have a caller on this decision. Let's hear from Patty in Berkeley. Hi, Patty.
Hi. Hold on. Let me... Okay. Hi.
Hi.
I agree very much with what the previous gentleman said. I'm not sure if he's a lawyer or not. I am not. I'm a social science researcher in women's rights. So I'm looking at this from the point of view that this may very well backfire and will broaden issues of stockholders' personal equity, if you will, in these closely held firms, being able to be called into cases against the corporation. Because under the concept of piercing the corporate veil, which would hold, and it's in, it comes into play in a variety of legal cases where corporations say, well, we're not responsible, or we're only responsible for a certain percentage. But the fact of the matter is, if a corporation is going to be treated as an individual with regard to religious rights in a country that holds state and church separate, but now we're changing some of those concepts, and the rhetoric could be argued backwards against these closely held firms in cases against them, liability cases or such, and under the issue of being an individual or a or indeed a corporation that you just can't get to the stockholders, I would say that if it can be pierced on one end, it can be pierced on the other. So if they have individual rights to impose their religious views and values on their employees, then indeed wouldn't plaintiffs and or employees have the ability in court to have their lawyers argue the fact that the stockholders also have individual responsibilities, and i.e. under the concept of piercing.
All right. Well, Patty, we have to take a break, but thank you for the question, and I'll ask our guests after the break the significance of this. I mean, for the first time in history, the Supreme Court ruled that corporations have the right to exercise religious beliefs like people or churches do. So that's another important element of this decision, and we'll get a response after the break. Today, we are talking about the latest Supreme Court decisions. This year's term ends today. We received one of the most watched decisions in the case, Sebelius versus Hobby Lobby. The court ruled that closely held corporations don't have to provide certain kinds of contraception to employees if it violates their religious beliefs. We'll talk about more decisions right after this.
It is your call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. To join today's conversation, call 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free call, 866-798-8255, or you can post your question or comment at yourcallradio.org, where you will also find links related to today's program. Coming up in 30 minutes, World Have Your Say from the BBC. Today, Facebook has been criticized after it emerged that it conducted a psychological experiment on nearly 700,000 users without their knowledge. Has Facebook done anything wrong or behaved any differently to any other commercial company trying to improve its services? We'll hear all sides of the debate. Also, in the second half of today's World Have Your Say, they'll be coming live to us from the World Cup in Rio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about what we can do to support sweatshop workers around the globe. It's been 15 months since 1,137 Bangladeshis died in a collapsing building while making clothes for Americans and Europeans. NGOs say that protests and boycotts no longer work because multinationals are just too large. So what are the solutions? That's tomorrow. And then on Wednesday, we will talk about antibiotics and antibiotic resistance. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we are talking about the Supreme Court. The term ended today, and this morning we received the court's final decision, so we are going over some of these, and we'd love to hear from you. What questions do you have about the decisions? Which cases have you been following closely? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Today we're joined by Jody Jacobson, editor-in-chief of RH Reality Check, a daily publication providing news about sexual and reproductive health and justice issues. Tejinder Singh is an attorney with Goldstein and Russell and a contributor to the SCOTUS blog. He's argued before the Supreme Court and lower courts. Jesse Choper is the Earl Warren Professor of Public Law at UC Berkeley, who has taught and written about constitutional law and the Supreme Court. Professor Choper, just one more question about Hobby Lobby. How significant is the fact that for the first time in history, the Supreme Court ruled that corporations have the right to exercise religious beliefs? How important is that?
Well, it's not insignificant, but on the one hand. On the other hand, they've never been asked, to my knowledge, to rule on that question before. I want to say that your caller, you know, made a perfectly good point about piercing the corporate veil, which is essentially what they did here in corporation law terms. But I want to say it is very difficult to pierce the corporate veil beyond a very closely held and closely controlled corporation. So you're not going to get Walmart, even though you have, you know, majority ownership by at large corporations. Very hard to pierce. And under these circumstances, they held that the policy of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, they really, this involved an interpretation of the intention of Congress, which was to restore what had been a very pro-religious freedom position by the Supreme Court itself, a constitutional position. And the court overturned that decision and said the Constitution doesn't give much protection to some, but not as much as it did before. And Congress went and tried to pass this statute to do that. And to the extent that it applies to the federal government, it's a statute that is constitutional. So I don't think anybody made light of the fact that the issue of freedom of choice is a very, very important one for women and other people as well. But I think you want to remember that the Supreme Court was willing to assume that that was a compelling interest, but said in the Hobby Lobby case that there were other ways to go about doing it. After all, they have done it for nonprofits that Congress wants to. The point about not getting any action out of Congress today, well, I mean, that's a truism, and no one can argue with that, but at least seriously. On the other hand, you got a pretty good lobby, if you will, in respect to women's rights to choose. So, who knows? You might get that through. There's an election coming up. That's not unimportant.
Mm. Well, and again, the Hobby Lobby decision was 5-4. Jody, before we let you go, I wanted to also ask you about the buffer zone decision handed down on Thursday. It was a unanimous decision. The Supreme Court struck down a Massachusetts law that barred protests and counseling near abortion clinics. This law was enacted in 2007, and it created a 35-foot buffer zone around entrances to abortion clinics. The state officials in Massachusetts said they had to pass this law because there was so much harassment and violence in Massachusetts, including a shooting at two facilities in 1994. What was the reasoning behind this unanimous decision?
Well, I think this decision speaks to how grossly out of touch with reality many of our Supreme Court justices, unfortunately, are. If you ever have ever been at a clinic that provides abortion care, some of which also provide many other kinds of care for which people are trying to get there, you know that it is like running through, you know, a football tackle zone, and for the court to decide that so-called counselors, let's just be clear that these are people who let's say I'm the woman in question, have not invited to counsel me, whose advice I have not sought out, and who is not legally certified to counsel anybody on anything, is in my face telling me what I should do with my body and my life. That was seen as a higher principle than enabling people to get to the clinic safely and without being accosted. If you don't think that women going to an abortion clinic have already decided what they're doing and know that there are lots of people against what they're doing who are standing 35 feet away with, you know, disgusting concocted pictures and things that they throw at you, calling you a slut and a baby killer and whatever, those women know that already. So you've got this sense that some areas, like the Supreme Court, are worthy of being protected by a buffer zone. And mind you, I'm sure all of the justices drive in through a protected garage, yet women going to a clinic are supposed to be subject to these so-called counselors, which in fact is one of the grossest forms of personal transgression I can even think of. So I just find it really distressing that even, although I know some of my lawyer colleagues have theories for why it happened this way, that even justices like Elena Kagan said, why would you need a 35-foot buffer zone? It's really a little bit out of reality, not understanding what actually happens in those places and how frightened and aggressively accosted women are.
Professor Chipper, what are your thoughts on this? Because in Northern California, probably most people haven't interacted with protesters going into clinics. But like Jody said, I mean, if you go somewhere like Jackson, Mississippi, these are not quiet conversations. I mean, I've been there and they yell at you right when you walk out of your car. You know, don't kill me, mommy. Why are you hurting me? I mean, yelling in your face. And I was struck by Chief Justice Roberts, who wrote, quote, petitioners are not protesters. What are your thoughts on that, Professor Chopper?
Well, it is pretty clear that the abortion opponents won the battle in that case, in that the court held that the state statute at issue violated the right of free speech. On the one hand, I think it is critical to understand that they have won the battle, but they may well have lost the war, because Chief Justice Roberts' opinion, which found a violation of the First Amendment in favor of abortion opponents in this case, laid out a map for states to pass laws that would be okay, you couldn't do this. So the abortion opponents they won here, but they did not win generally, I don't think, in the future, because he said if you can pass a law against such matters as blocking or interfering or obstructing, I mean, he used those words and others as well, intimidating, if you can pass a law against intimidating women who want to go and get an abortion, then that would be okay. So I think the objections to the first decision that we talked about are real, and I don't know that they're going to change very quickly, absent a change in the composition of the court. But on this one, there are, the same court, it seems to me, is very much said that is four liberals plus Chief Justice Roberts, who wrote, very sympathetic to having a law passed in which you can stop these people who intimidate, block, or interfere with access to an abortion clinic.
And to Jinder, do you think that the buffer zone decision will open up challenges to limitations on protests in other places? For example, when you go to political conventions, especially the big ones, you have these free speech cages. So you're quote, not allowed to walk in front of like a hotel that's having a party for politicians. You have to go across the street and in a cage.
Yeah, I think that the same First Amendment analysis would certainly apply, right? This is a restriction on the time, place, and manner in which people can speak. One thing that I thought was really interesting about the McCullen decision is, you know, the dissent in McCullen has an argument, and I think it's not a bad one generally, that this actually is not content-neutral regulation, right? That the only reason these buffer zones exist is to, you know, inhibit a certain form of speech, and that is protests. Now, one can ask whether there are good reasons to limit those protests in those contexts. I think there probably are. But the same logic, of course, would apply to other kinds of protests, right? And so you have these sort of restricted zones, or more particularly, these areas where people can't protest, you know, I do think that those challenges can cite this case favorably, and they may even have a strong argument based on the idea that, you know, what's going on here is really designed to restrict their particular message. It will really depend on the circumstances of the given protest, I think. You know, one problem with that those cases always face, though, is that normally those things are organized, you know, there's less time to mount a legal challenge in those cases than there is just a permanent structure like a reproductive health clinic. And so getting those cases through the courts is a little trickier. Mm.
Jody, how will this decision affect other clinics around the country? And what changes do you expect to see as a result of this decision?
Well, I don't know about I don't want to speculate on changes because I don't know what the strategy is at this moment. So shortly after that decision came down, I will say that we have a huge problem, and it is not often named, of religious and anti-choice terrorism in this country. It is people bombing clinics, people killing other people, people accosting people on the sidewalks, intimidating, terrorizing people, even when they're just going for contraception or what have you, and it's really none of their business what they're going for. So I think that, you know, in terms of clinic folks, they are very worried because they are followed to their homes, they are followed to their other places of business. This is a no-privacy zone for anyone who is a woman or who's affiliated with reproductive health clinics. And I think it's very easy to sort of look at this in a very legal, technical sense and parse the words of the decision, but to completely miss the point of what happens to doctors, nurses, staffers, and women seeking health care every day of the week in this country. They are intimidated, they are terrorized, they are threatened, and it is really at a level of, there's no level of it that's acceptable, but as you know, as far as the sort of legal versus the reality, again, I think that we have a very great gap between where real people live and what the law looks like, and sort of thinking through how this might go down the pike in cases when actual real people are having their rights violated every single day and being terrorized. Mm.
Well, Jody, thanks again for joining us this morning. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Jody Jacobson is editor-in-chief of RH Reality Check, a daily publication providing news and analysis on sexual and reproductive health and justice issues. You can check out their reporting at yourcallradio.org. And Professor Chopra, We're just getting a few more emails about the free speech zones that have been used by police to prevent, government officials from hearing protesters. Just once again, do you think this ruling will affect these free speech zones?
Would you repeat that, please?
Will the buffer zone ruling affect the establishment of the free speech zones?
Yeah. Once again, it seems to me that this is a court, even though with a majority of conservative justices on it, that is very sympathetic to free speech. All right? That includes certainly Justice Kennedy on the conservative leaning side, and Chief Justice Roberts to a significant extent. So I would say that they're going to examine pretty closely any kind of buffer zone. And if you just say no one can approach at all, one of the conventions of the national conventions of the parties, I think they're going to take a careful look at that. So just as it seems to me, they take a careful look at these buffer zones that keep abortion opponents away from the women who want to go into the abortion clinic. And the fact that they struck this down, Ms. Jacobson talked about the fact that you can't get a law through Congress. Well, that's true. But these are state legislatures, and there have been a lot of laws that are protecting women who want to go into a clinic. This one they struck down. But I think a lot of states are going to go and take another look at this and enact laws that conform to what the Supreme Court was said okay to. Chief Justice Roberts' opinion said okay to in the case the other day.
All right. Well, thank you for the email, Michael. And let's hear next from John in Santa Cruz. Hi, John.
Hi there. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Great. Thanks for the great show, as always. My question is about the Hobby Lobby decision. And it's my understanding currently that it's very difficult for a person to get out of paying taxes for wars based on religious grounds. You have to be a really brave person who's willing to get hassled by the government and blah, blah, blah. So I'm curious whether this would open up, make it easier for people to say, well, I don't want to pay for invading other countries and for drones and that kind of things because my religious... Or what if a church would get fed up that said...
All right, John, sorry, I could hear you well. I don't think our guests can because your line's a little bad. But to Jinder, John wanted to ask how the Hobby Lobby decision would affect paying war taxes if you're against it because of religious reasons.
I think the answer is not at all. A separate line of cases is kind of already dealt with that objection. I don't think anything in Hobby Lobby really changes the outcome under those cases. I think, there's also part of the Hobby Lobby decision that specifically talks about, objections to taxation and just concludes taxation is different. I think the short answer is zero.
All right. Well, thank you for the call, John. Let's now talk about the cell phone decision. This decision came down Wednesday. Again, it was a unanimous decision, a huge victory for privacy rights. The court ruled that the police need warrants to search the cell phones of people they arrest. And this decision will offer protection to 12 million people arrested every year, many for minor crimes. And we've got a couple of questions about this one. So let's go to Maddie in Monterey. Hi, Maddie.
Good morning. This is something I've been following on the cell phones. And, as it exists, the Supreme Court has basically come down and said, get a warrant because of the privacy issues. And there are so many things that are on cell phones, aside from the things that were mentioned. I mean, there's health records. There's something that you would have to go to and go get a warrant and put it on a doctor's office now is in a cell phone.
Right.
And so, but I think that a lot of people not knowing what their rights are will freely give away permission to police officers to do this. And police officers, will they be downloading? What I want to know is what do you think, what methods law enforcement will now use in order to try to circumvent, because they're always trying to do that, circumvent and get around this? And will they download information? And how long can they keep information that they've downloaded out of your cell phone?
Well, and it's also important to point out that a lot of people in the legal world say this ruling also applies to searches of tablet and laptop computers, and it might apply to searches of homes and businesses. So, Professor Chopper, what are your thoughts on this? How do you think police are going to respond?
Well, you know, I want to say this was pretty clear. I mean, this was a unanimous decision of the court, which stood up for privacy. And it seems to me took a very, just as your caller just indicated, it took a very realistic look at the sort of information that you have in a cell phone. I mean, I think the courts said it records almost all aspects of someone's life. So the other point is also important. You want to get a warrant. Now, you can get it. Now, how they're going to frame that warrant is an interesting question. That is to say, if the police say, look, we have probable cause to believe that there's a conversation in the last 3 days in which they discuss this murder, okay, that we're now investigating, and they show that there's reasonable cause to believe it. Well, you can't, you know, it's a lot more difficult to go through this than it is to go through a series of even papers in someone's desk. So they give it to the judge, probably, and they let the judge, what they call in camera, that is not publicly, review it in a careful way and find out if there really was such a conversation within the last 2 days. You know, there's certainly ways to figure out how to limit it to that, right, instead of giving the police the cell phone, let them do whatever they want with it. So they're quite serious about this. But if you have probable cause, while there're going to be problems, it's perfectly clear that you can you can grab hold of a cell phone and have some way of trying to get the information out of it. I think the court will look to make sure it's a very protective way, like what is called, again, an in-camera or within the court itself investigation. Have the judge take a look at it.
And Chief Justice Roberts was pretty clear when he was talking about or writing about what police should do if they want to search a cell phone in connection with an arrest. He wrote, quote, get a warrant. So it's pretty straightforward.
That's right. It's simple. Yeah, and I can't think of any. It's going to be very difficult to find an exception to that. In which you say, well, they're what are called exigent circumstances, which require that the investigation be, you know, be made immediately. Well, I guess one can imagine some, but I haven't as yet. Maybe Sajinder can.
Well, we're almost out of time. I wanted to talk about another decision that came down today. It was a 5-4 decision. The court ruled that some government employees do not have to pay fees to labor unions representing them. But the court did not strike down a decades-old precedent that required many public sector workers to pay union fees. Tejinder, just quickly, how significant is this decision?
It's mostly significant for what it didn't do, which is go, you know, the extra mile and really destroy public unions, which that's something that was on the table today. And the court didn't do it. And that, you know, sigh of relief breathed across the nation, I think, by public unions and folks who work for them. This decision did decide that these workers, these are home care workers, and they nominally anyway are employed by the patients who they visit at home, and not by the state. And so it did decide that those folks, shouldn't have to contribute funds to public employee unions that bargain on their behalf if they don't want to. But it stopped short of overruling an old case that said, for example, teachers still have to contribute those funds. And if it had overruled that case, I think we would have seen basically the end of public employee unions as we know them.
Wow.
The door remains open for the court to go that next step in the future. And there are cases, as I understand, working their way through the courts, which will raise that question more directly. But for now, anyway, you know, what we're looking at is a relatively contained blow to public unions' ability to raise funds.
And we've got about 2 minutes left. To Jinder, which case were you closely watching in the last couple weeks? Any decision surprise you, or you know what was really on the top of, at the top of your list?
You know, one case that I was watching, I think it was the most significant case for businesses this term, is a case called Halliburton versus Erica P. John Fund. And this was a case about whether securities class actions could basically continue to exist. Those class actions have relied on a presumption called the fraud on the market, which assumes that everyone who buys publicly traded stock is relying on the market price to reflect all of the available information. And what that allows folks to do is they can all say, well, we all relied on the same price, therefore we can organize as a class to bring a lawsuit for securities fraud. There was a chance that the court was going to get rid of that presumption, and if it did, securities class actions as we know them wouldn't exist anymore, which would have been a major problem for folks who are worried about fraud in the financial sector. The court didn't go that far. The court said that the presumption remains intact. It gave defendants the right to rebut the presumption at the class certification stage, which is really not terribly different from how practice was working before that. So this was, again, another blockbuster, potential blockbuster case that didn't bust the block, but it was one of the biggest cases this year on the calendar overall.
And Professor Chopra, what about you? What was at the top of your list?
Pardon me?
What was at the top of your list? What decision did you closely watch?
I was looking at the recess veto case in which President Obama has tried in every way he can to get some of these appointments, some of these nominations confirmed. And the Supreme Court, I think, ruled largely in favor of the executive branch to do this, but not completely, in which they said if it's any recess that exceeds, that is 10 days or more, is one in which the president can make a recess appointment. And it doesn't make any difference when the recess appointment occurred. The recess, I mean, occurred.
And you can read that decision and all of the other decisions that we mentioned at yourcallradio.org. Again, the Supreme Court term ended today. We've got all the decisions now. We did a show a couple of weeks ago looking at another set of decisions, and so we'll also include that link at yourcallradio.org. Jesse Chopra is the Earl Warren Professor of Public Law at UC Berkeley, and Tejinder Singh is an attorney with Goldstein & Russell and a contributor to the SCOTUS blog. Thank you both for joining us. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. What can we do to support sweatshop workers around the globe? On the next Your Call, we'll look at how we can go beyond boycotts to improve the lives of garment workers. It's been 15 months since 1,137 Bangladeshis died in a collapsing building while making clothes for Americans and Europeans. So what has changed since then? NGOs say protests and boycotts no longer work because multinationals are just too big. So what are the solutions? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.